We treat our Bible with love and with respect. We know that the Bible enshrines some of the most valuable of the insights of the race. We also know that structurally and institutionally, the Bible reflects the age in which it was written. The center of devotion for biblical man was a sanctuary, the temple in Jerusalem. Here, an hereditary priest class performed the various rituals and ceremonies. Here, the central act of devotion was the offering of sacrifice to the Lord. And the ultimate act of personal devotion was to attend these sacrifices, to undertake a pilgrimage from your community to Jerusalem for the worship. Now, in the year 70 of the Common Era, just about 1900 years ago, the armies of the Roman Emperor Vespasian leveled the city of Jerusalem, and they razed the temple. That form of our religious life, which had been central for 1,000 years, was shattered beyond repair. Our people transmuted their devotion to the temple into liturgy. If you look carefully at the traditional Amidah, the central petition of the traditional service, you will read there these themes: may God return unto Zion, may he allow the temple to be rebuilt quickly in our day, may he allow his worship to be returned to the Devir, to the Holy of Holies. The age of biblical man was over. The rebuilding of the temple was not to be. 2 years ago, when the temple mount, Mount Zion, fell again under Jewish sovereignty, there was no real attempt made to remake, to reestablish, to rebuild that sanctuary. It seems inconceivable to us to make as central in our lives again a priestly hierarchy, the offering of sacrifices, and all the attendant pageantry of that ancient temple. But the liturgy has been written, and it continues to reflect the hope, the ancient hope, the immemorial hope of this rebuilding. And we will, of course, explain it symbolically, and it is an effective tie with the past. But nevertheless, it does not take a great stretch of the imagination to understand and to empathize with that paralysis of spirit which must have overwhelmed our ancestors as they stood with tears in their eyes, those who survived, and looked at the smoking remnants of Tiferet Yisrael, the glory of Israel. Here was the place where for 100 generations their parents had come, and their ancestors had found the divine. Here was the place where on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur, the high priest, burdened with the sins of his household and of all Israel, would enter into the Holy of Holies there to gain atonement, at-one-ment again for Israel. Here was where security and salvation were promised and confirmed. And now it was all gone, shattered and ruined. The rabbis of that generation said, Yom Shaharab Beit HaMikdash Lo Nireit HaRakia B'Techarta. But from the day when the temple was destroyed, the heavens could no longer be seen in all of their clear blue beauty. Now, Rabbinic Judaism, that Judaism which emerges from this destruction, the Judaism which we are analyzing this morning, Rabbinic Judaism's unique contribution to our lives was its ability to take a people broken by tragedy, whose pious habits, whose ways of life had come to an abrupt end, give them new life, new vigor, a new sense of mission and of purpose. Rabbinic Judaism's mood, its unique contribution, is an ability to teach this people, Israel, how to live with tragedy, how to live in an insecure world, in a world where the innocence of the youth, the innocence of the youth of the race, when we had our temple and we had our land and when we had our independence and when we had a sense of our power numerically among other nations of power, when all this had vanished and we were now alien, strangers, dispersed, a small, pitifully small minority among the great millions of the world. It is the ability to transmute tragedy into hope, to find some meaning in the darkness, to see a light at the end of the tunnel. It is the unique ability, the unique contribution of the rabbinic Jew. The story is told of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a man, Pharisaic leader, one of the elders of his party at the time of the destruction of the temple, the man who somehow gained from the Romans the permission to establish a Torah school outside of Jerusalem after the defeat in Yavne, where our people began to rebuild and regroup and reform. It is told of this Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that one day, shortly after the destruction, he and a disciple, Joshua, were on a trip through the Judean hills. And they came to one of those places and these winding hill roads where you could overlook Mount Zion. And Joshua looked out over the ruins, the emptiness, the desolation of what had been the glory of Israel. He began to wail and to weep and to lament. Woe unto us that all this has happened. Woe unto us that the place where we gained atonement, where salvation was promised to us, is now in ruins. Yochanan ben Zakkai turned to his student and he said, Joshua, do not be so distraught. Why do you weep so loudly? There is another atonement, another place of salvation for Israel. And where is this to be found? In deeds of loving kindness. Or has it not been written in the prophets that the Lord desires mercy and not sacrifice? The rabbis were continually explaining the tears, the grief of their people in such a way as to make Israel understand that though they stood at one of the midnight hours of our history, there was yet a dawn. There was yet reason to hope. There was something even that could be learnt in the tragedy itself. And that is the glory and the skill of our rabbinic leaders. They came at a time when the history of our people turned 180 degrees. At the beginning of this era, 50 years before the rebellion against the Romans, our people numbered perhaps 20% of the Roman Empire. We were a puppet kingdom of Rome, but domestically sovereign. We were among the most important minorities in the empire. Great cities like Antioch and Alexandria in Egypt had Jewish majorities. We were a popular faith. Many of the courtiers and the nobles and the councils of Rome were interested in Judaism. Some were espousing our faith. We had a sense of our purpose, a sense of confidence, a sense of manliness, a sense of we were of this world and very much in it. And then in 80 years we were undone. Because of the rapaciousness of the Roman overlords, because of their own impatience, our people rose in rebellion in Judea in 68. They were crushed, and there were bloody massacres. And about 50 years later, in the year 112 of the Common Era, the Jews of diaspora, the Jews of Libya and of Egypt and of Crete and of Cyprus rose in rebellion against Rome, and they were crushed with great loss of life. So much so that Alexandria, which had had 1 million Jews, is said to have been left with less than a few thousand. And just a few years later, the Jews of Judea rose in rebellion again in the great rebellion of Bar Kozeba, we know as Bar Kokhba, and that rebellion was crushed. And it's estimated today that between 3 and 5 million Jews died in battle or were massacred in these three rebellions against Rome. A people which had come into this area confident now found themselves bruised and bleeding and dispersed. We could no longer enter the city of Jerusalem, once our capital. We could no longer live in the cities of Judea, once the center of Jewish sovereignty. There were a few scattered settlements in the Galilee. There were a few people living here or there throughout the Roman Empire. But really, with the exception of the Jews of Parthia, the Jews in Persia, far to the east, who were outside the power of Rome, with the exception of that community, which emerged from this century largely unscathed, our people were beaten, bruised, defeated. And had the people of Israel, the leaders of Israel, the rabbis, not had this unique capacity of finding the meaning of tragedy, finding the hope which is implicit in despair, Israel would never have been rebuilt. We would not be here today. The story is told of Rabbi Akiba. And a few years after Yochanan ben Zakkai, he and some companions were along perhaps the same road. And they came also to a vantage point, a lookout point, which overlooked the desolate city of Jerusalem. And his companions began to weep and to lament. And there was just the suspicion of a smile playing around the face of Akiba. And they said to him, "Akiba, how can you smile?" And he answered their question with a question. He said, "How can you lament?" And you know, this habit of answering a question with a question is not a simple evasion. The answers that we get depend upon the questions that we ask. And sometimes the question, if we can, by the question, put a conversation in a different perspective, we can get an answer which gives us far more understanding than we would have otherwise had before. Now, the companions of Akiba assumed that when you saw the ruins, the broken glory of Israel, there was nothing to do but to pull one's hair and beat one's breast and to weep. And they answered him, "What else can we do? Here's the Holy Temple. Here's the place, the Holy of Holies, where the priest gained atonement for our people. Here's where our people were renewed spiritually. Here's the place where the covenant was bound tight." And Akiba answered, "You want to know why I'm not weeping? I'll answer you. For the same reason you are lamenting. You lament the destruction. You lament the ruins. But remember the prophecies of old. Had it not been foretold that Jerusalem would be reduced to ruins and the temple would be destroyed for the sins of Israel, and had it not been for this destruction, we would not now be looking confidently towards that second promise, that Jerusalem would be rebuilt, and the temple would be reformed, reconstituted. Out of hope, out of despair, hope. Out of defeat, a sense that somehow we were moving into a new future." Now, the rabbis didn't deny the reality of the defeat. The rabbis did not attempt to do what some do today, to say that all that's evil, all that's painful, all that's illness in the world is unreal, and if we only apply our mind with the power of positive thinking, with some kind of spiritual science, we will deny the reality of this evil. It was a bitter, bitter hour. And they made no attempt to deny it. But they also knew that for all the glory that had once been implicit in the sanctuary, for all the reverence that the ancients had associated with the temple, even as we associate reverence with this building, for all that reverence, for all that sense of holiness, the temple had in some strange ways been a stumbling block to a true understanding of the faith. Many had assumed that the temple itself guaranteed God's favor, and others had assumed that its sacrifices were truly the devotion that God required rather than the sacrifices of a humble and contrite heart. There are in every generation people who mistake the ritual for its ultimate meaning, who place all importance on the ceremony rather than the act which it spiritually invokes. And so it had been with the temple. Hundreds of years before, the prophets of Israel had spoken in the name of God, "Why do you bring to me, O Judeans, these vain oblations? They are an offering of abomination unto me, your new moons and your Sabbaths and your holding of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity along with the solemn assembly." They had attacked this emphasis on cult and ceremony and sacrifice. So at least this was a virtue. This was what Akiba was teaching and Yochanan ben Zakkai. Here was a new insight which could be confirmed and underscored. The people made to understand that it was not the sacrifice, not the ceremony, but the way they lived, their moral stance, which guaranteed or denied them God's favor. Out of despair, hope, and out of tragedy, a sense of meaning. We use a word. We use it often. That word is faith. And we assume that faith, we very often assume that faith is a series of lines, of words, of doctrine, catechism, something that one of the historic religions has thrown up from its experience and set forth as the truth, the whole truth. And we recognize, do we not, that logic and reason often can poke holes in these doctrines. They seem inconsistent or take us beyond where common sense and logic can lead us. But when we argue in this way, we misunderstand the meaning of faith. Faith is not the affirmation of deity. Faith, rather, is the affirmation of purpose. For a deity who was not good and not benign and not careful of man, for whom man was a plaything, would not be a deity worth believing in. Would have gained nothing, and he would have gained nothing by such a faith. Faith is the commitment made by our hearts that behind all the noise, all the cacophony, all the shrill, there's somehow a divine symphony. That behind all the confusion and all the chaos, there's somehow an unfolding purpose. That when we ask the question, why am I alive, we answer that there is purpose for my being here. What must I do? Be concerned with the unfolding possibilities of mankind. To hold to this view is to take hold of a faith. And it's horribly difficult, as you and I well know. What the rabbis did in their day was to take hold of a faith, the faith that there was purpose, meaning, direction to life. Even though they walked in the valley of the shadow of death, they somehow could affirm life itself, and that was their triumph. Not all of them. It's not easy. Among the compatriots of Akiba, there was a young man by the name of Elisha ben Abuya. Now, Elisha ben Abuya is a fascinating person. He apparently was the greatest of the spiritual geniuses who grew up in that generation. He was the kind of man who, as a young person, would have graduated high school at 12 or 13. At 15, he would have had his PhD from some university. His generation, if you read the literature of the Tanaim, the literature of this first and second century, you realize that really this was the Wunderkind, the Eloi, the young genius, like of which comes along only once or twice in a generation. People expected the greatest things of him. And even when later in his life, Elisha ben Abuya uttered the greatest of heresies, those who had studied with him and knew his mind somehow could not push him off. They always were going to him and saying, come home, be one of us. Now, Elisha Ben Abuya grew up in this era of bloodshed and of uncertainty. He saw the destruction of the temple. He saw the destruction of Jerusalem. He saw his teachers murdered by the Romans. And he lost his faith, not in God, but in providence, in the meaning of life. And he said, late Dean, for late Dayan, there is no justice, and there's no judge. Like many of us today, many of the contemporaries today, he looked at the world, he looked at Auschwitz, he looked at Hiroshima, he looked at Nigeria, he looked at the borders of Israel, he looked at the bloodshed, he looked at the slums, he looked at the violence, he heard the noise, he heard the guns. Late Dean, or late Dayan, there's no judge, there's no justice. All is sound and fury, signifying nothing. And Elisha Ben Abuya lost his faith, and he moved away, he moved aside. And he's known in our tradition as Acher, one who went over, another, not one of us. Because the others, men of lesser genius perhaps, were more steadfast. And when the thunder roared and the lightning struck, instead of flinching and closing their eyes the way Elisha Ben Abuya had done and to say, all is purposeless, all is meaningless, they somehow had the courage to look the storm, the whirlwind, the fury of man square on and to say, we can live with this. We can learn from this. On Judaism, you'll never find poverty glorified. Poverty debases a man. Poverty demeans life. The rabbi said that if you were to put the sufferings brought on by poverty in one pan of a scale and all the other sufferings of men in the other pan, the sufferings of poverty would outweigh all the other anguish. Here was a generation which knew poverty. They were stripped of their land. They were robbed of their possessions. They were exiled from their homes. They knew what it meant to be destitute and to be bereft. And yet the rabbi said that the good Lord looked around the earth for all the fine and good qualities with which he could bless Israel. And he could find no quality better than that of poverty. For poverty brings a man to God. When we are without bread, when we haven't enough clothing to wear, when we haven't oils in their terms, we haven't the things with which to keep clean, to keep our own dignity, then somehow we turn to the God of mercy. We find him. And they were saying something more than the common sense observation that once we've tried all the social agencies and all of our relatives and the friends and the government, and we found that there is no way of solving our particular need, no income to be derived, we turn to God in one last act of despair. As Lincoln said once, you know, he often found himself down on his knees because he had no place else to go. They were saying this, but something more. They were saying, in effect, that faith cannot be a haphazard, careless enterprise. That you'll never find God if you're not driven to find him. That only great emotional intensity can push you through the veil that separates men and God. But when there's something like poverty which drives us to need, and need which drives us to pour out our emotions, to seek the ultimate meaning, then somehow we break through and we break into the sphere of the divine. And we find God. They had this ability to find meaning in suffering. They looked upon suffering as potentially edifying. We look upon suffering as simply pain. They spoke of the Yisurin Shel Ahava, the sufferings which God imposes upon us because of his love for us. You've seen it. You've seen the lovely young people who grow up in abundance, who are taught to have and to spend, who marry other young people, brought up in abundance, taught to have and to spend. And they create a little love nest. It's very cute, very quaint. And everything seems giddy and happy and irrelevant to the world, which is the real world. And they go along living very much for themselves, in a sense being more and more selfish all the time. And then something happens. A child is born. The child is born with a serious illness. And these two giddy young things, irrelevant grasshopper people, are suddenly brought down into life itself, into the real world, and they become different people, do they not? In saving, healing, and caring for the child, they develop a sensitivity not only to their own, but other children suffering from the same illness, and somehow to a cause, and from that cause to many of the causes in the community. Yisurin Shelahava, the sufferings which God brings upon us out of his love for us. There's an almost unconscious desire among many of our children to leave the comfort that we give them and to go into a garret, into a cold and bleak corner of the city, into the Greenwich Villages and the Haight-Asbury's, and to touch rock bottom. What are they doing? What are they trying to do? To suffer. To learn what life is all about by touching the raw reality. We wall them in from it. And they know that they've got to somehow break through if they're going to find themselves. And so they impose upon themselves Yisurin Shelahava, the sufferings of love. And the rabbis developed a whole litany of the possible teachings of suffering. Some of our anguish, they said, is intended to bring us up short, to make us recognize the failures of character, the headlong ambition which we have become involved in, to make us realize that we're not leading a life worth the living. And some of these sufferings are intended to force us out of our material frame of mind back into the human frame of mind, to think less of things and more of people, to remind us of the sufferings of the world. That when we read the black headlines, we're reading of somebody else's tears and somebody else's anguish and somebody else's grief, and not simply a statistic of terror. And some are intended in order to prepare us, the rabbis would say, for an afterlife, so that we are purified here and purged here, that we may not have to be, in their terms, purified in some purgatory. And we do not share that belief. But surely many of us have been purged and made the better for the dark ways that we have walked, for the suffering which we have endured, for the loneliness and the pain which has been ours. And we have found strength within us and a maturity and a sensitivity that perhaps we did not know exist. Let me close this attempt to describe the overarching mood of the rabbinic world, its skill, its artistry, its in transmuting the tragic into teaching. The story, a legend told about Moses. You recall that when Moses went up to Mount Sinai and received the Ten Commandments, he brought the commandments down. He saw that the people had built a golden calf, and he was so angered by the scene of their lack of loyalty with God that he took these tablets and he smashed them to the ground. Well, this is a version told by the rabbis 2,000 years ago of that story. Moses went up to Mount Sinai, and he received there the commandments, and God engraved the teachings upon the commandments. And Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and he saw the golden calf and the people dancing in devotion around this idol. And he was aghast. And he looked at the tablets that were in his hands, and he found that they had been erased of their writing. The stone was now clear. And he heard a voice, the voice of God. And God said unto Moses, "The people will come to read, to know these commandments, the laws of life, only through suffering. And Israel has suffered. And Israel has been enslaved, and Israel has been persecuted, and Israel has been beaten. And it is my firm belief that the spiritual sensitivity, the religious maturity which is ours today, is in largest measure due to the Yisurin Shel Ahava, the afflictions which God has placed upon this people, which have kept us from being arrogant ever, which has kept us from assuming that we are better than another, which has kept our heart broken and therefore open, susceptible of fellow feeling, careful of the sensitivities of others, aware of the demands rightly placed upon us by the love of another. Our hearts have been broken, our spirits have been shattered, and out of that defeat has come the glory of our faith. Out of the glory, destruction of the glory of Israel, the temple, came the reconstruction of the true glory of Israel, our spiritual world. And that, my friends, is the mood, the meaning, and the message of the rabbis. Amen.